that's a problem with festivals like Ulriksberg and Nickelsdorf and blah blah blah. Well, if you just keep on booking the same things, you know, you would have the audience will stay because they love it, but you don't get new audience in. And I have a very clear experience, really interesting. We played with Fire Orchestra in Peitz in East Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Fuck was it?
Oh my god, this is a
Friday. Yeah, last yeah. Friday. And that's together with MERS, the longest going festival in Germany. But it was on the east side, you know, so it was mainly East German mm-hmm. jazz musicians and Polish musicians playing there. But anyway, we played there in a church, and it was packed with people, but everyone was older than you and me, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's fine, you know, I play for them, you know, it's an audience.
Of course.
But the day after, we went with Fire, with a trio, to Warsaw in Poland, and we played a festival called Match and Fuse, which is a traveling festival in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And they have outspoken a quite mixed program of experimental music.
Mm-hmm.
But we played it, it's called the Club Kulturalny something. It's that amazing looking building opposite the train station. If you know Warsaw, you know, that looks like a Metropolis building or mm-hmm. something.
Never been there, but I can imagine.
Yeah, it's a fantastic building with a huge cinema and cafes and clubs, and it's all culture. It's a fantastic place. And we had, I don't know, we had a 300-400 people audience, and everyone was young, basically, or mixed. There were some older people there too, but it was mainly a young audience, and by gender also really mixed, a lot of women in the audience, and a totally different vibe. And I have to say, if I have to choose, of course I play for a mixed audience or a younger audience. Mm-hmm. You have much more feedback, and it's a totally different energy. When you play for the 60-year-old men dressed in black with beards, they know exactly what they want and what they need. And if you change something in that concept, they freak out and think it's awful, you know.
But doing this, let's say in the last context you mentioned, do you adjust in this kind of concerts?
No, we never adjust. I mean, we do the music we do. If you mm-hmm. start adjusting, then you can go and fuck yourself. I mean, in my world, I mean, that's, if you start to adjust to trying to please the audience, then you're in the wrong business. I think that's really that would be very dangerous.
I would like to ask you some yeah. questions about Sweden.
Yeah, sure.
I heard your Swedish ass project in Metelkova in Club Gromka. Would you tell me something about what is the condition of Swedish jazz now compared to the past you were somehow trying to interpret with the Swedish jazz?
I mean, the it's a long discussion, but it's Swedish jazz, from a European standpoint, was extremely advanced in the 50s and 60s, I would say, and together with England, Germany, and France, maybe the most interesting culture, the most interesting area in Europe, and Poland too, actually, but for creative jazz music, you know, mm-hmm. and in Sweden a lot from the beginning was building from Tristano, Lee Konitz kind of music,
mm-hmm.
and then in the 60s it turned into more free playing, a lot thanks to Don Cherry that moved to Sweden in the early 60s, and of course the Golden Circle and Cecil and everyone visiting, and Eiler was in Sweden for 1 year. So there was a lot going on, like amazing stuff. And Swedish jazz from the beginning was and is a project where we like to highlight and put focus on the all the great creative Swedish music that was. And we like to play it now. So and I I hate when people just try to play music the way it was or try to just copy it. So of course we like to put our own language and experience into the music. So we play compositions only from from the Swedish songbook and only basically from only 50s and 60s material. And then we try to we have a different setting, you know, with turntable and everything, but we try to change some parameters in the music. We try to fuck it up, we try to love it, we try to do anything we can, but we don't want to fuck it up. We like to keep true to the material, but for instance we can just use maybe a melody from a Lars Gullin piece and we give it a new harmony, or we give it new rhythm, or we give it a new form or something, but we might keep the melody because it's a great melody. We are playing around with the tradition of Swedish jazz, and this was a project from the beginning, and it's still in a way a project and a working group, but it's a very conceptual group. We only play Swedish jazz from the 50s and 60s. But of course in a contemporary way, otherwise it wouldn't be interesting.
What is the status of jazz and experimental music in Sweden now? We talked a little bit in Cerkno with Johan when he was part of the round table. But did you hear me?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
What in your opinion is the status of experimental music, especially music you are involved in Sweden now?
I think better than ever. Actually, from the perspective that there never been so many musicians involved in the scene like it is right now, which is fantastic, and there's never been so many female musicians active.
Yeah.
And that's a new thing, and that's I think it's a very, very important thing. I mean, if there's some ass-kicking female musicians, we have to really push it. We have to help it so other female musicians can get inspired and start playing this music, because it's been a man's business way too long, I think.
Yeah, it was man's music, actually.
Yeah, I mean, totally. But it's all changing, and I see it changing slowly, and sometimes it's good with slow changes and sometimes not. But it is changing slowly in Sweden and in Norway, for instance, a lot. And slowly maybe also in Europe, but the most positive signs with female musicians I see in Sweden and Norway at the moment. There's a lot of new players. So I would say that the health of the scene is really good. There's a big difference between Norway and Sweden, because Norway have a lot of money and Sweden don't. And the whole cultural climate changed in Sweden a lot the last 10 years, so it's a lot harder now. I mean, it's still okay if you compare to America or you compare to some of the Eastern European countries that doesn't have so much funding at all for culture.
It's funny that America is so fucked up now. I mean,
yeah, it's always been in a way.
Yeah, it's always been. You mentioned Norway or even Scandinavia. I wouldn't like to generalize too much. What would be the main difference between Sweden and Norway regarding cultural policy, basic economic conditions for your music?
No, it's a big difference because Norway has the oil and they have no national debt, and Sweden has a huge national debt and much higher unemployment, and I mean it's a quite funny situation, or tragic, or whatever way you want to see it, but because Norway belonged to Sweden for 200 years until 1905 when the union was broken up, thank God, and Norway got the independence. And Norway always been like the little brother, culturally and historically and everything, you know. And now it changed completely. So now, like, Norway is quite superior economically and also with culture and everything. And there's just much, much more money around. So if you're a Norwegian and you have projects or groups or you have a totally a much, much better chance to get money to travel and to realize things than you have in Sweden. And that's the way it is. I mean, I don't want to complain about it, not at all. It's great for the Norwegian scene, you know, but it's a huge difference if you look on the Swedish scene, because the Swedish scene used to be really good in the 80s and early 90s.
Then, but in that time, you had social democratic government.
Yeah, and then it changed, and the right-wing government actually, it's a long story, but really simple. We had social democrats running the business for decades, and then the right-wing came in, and as a symbol, they changed the whole, there was a very famous 1974 cultural change, and the institutions were built, and record labels connected to the state, and blah blah blah, supporting experimental music and music for from other countries, and music for youth and children and stuff like that, and that was all changed by the right-wing government. And then when the social democrats came back into power, they didn't change it back, they just let it be, you know, and and from there on we have a big change in the structure, I would say. But I mean, compared to other countries, it's still okay, you know, we have something is going on, but there was a very radical and dramatic change again only is it 6 or 7 years ago.
But what do you, what does this mean, that do you as a, let's say, creative musician, you are depending on market exclusively, or you can apply for some funding in Sweden?
I can still apply, but
do you get some funding?
We have a little bit of funding for FIRE, like on yearly basis, and we have a little bit of funding also for the thing. So it helps us if we travel, we can pay our travels sometimes with that money, which makes some tours in the US, for instance, or Australia possible. But if we tour in Europe, usually the travels are not so expensive, so we don't need the fundings really, you know, for that. And I never apply for money if I don't really need it. And the only time you really need it is when you travel to Japan or Brazil or something far away, and the money is like shit, or you work with in Ethiopia, for instance, and there's no money at all around. And then you need a little bit of economic help so you can get there, you know. I mean, this music is anyway not about the money.
Yeah.
If it was about the money, I would do something very different, you know. But of course, I mean, for a culture, it's important to have a exchange of music. So not only Swedes traveling in the world, but we also need to invite other musicians. And I was doing this a lot. I was setting up festivals and concerts, tours in Sweden like crazy, like in the 90s and the early 2000s. And this stopped, this possibility stopped. So I couldn't invite people. And that was not only people from the pre-jazz scene. It was like the contemporary music scene, and it was world music and all kinds of stuff. And when this stopped, the whole structure, we had an institution in Sweden run by the state, more or less, that put money into associations or musicians like me wanting to invite people to come and play and wanting them to tour around Sweden. We had the possibility, but now that's all gone. So that's a huge disadvantage, because if you don't have this exchange with other musicians and artists, the scene will slowly die. That's my opinion.
By the way, do you have an audience, a large enough audience in Sweden for your music?
It goes up and down. I mean, with the projects I work with FIRE or the thing, we have a big audience. We got lots of people coming out if we play a rock club or a jazz club. We fill the houses these days, you know. But it was not like that in the early days. It was not like that 10 years ago or 15 years ago, for sure not. So it's a better situation. I mean, for me personally, and for those two groups, it's a pretty good situation that we actually can get an audience coming out. But in general, this music doesn't really attract a huge audience. But I would say the audience is better now than it was 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. It's a bigger audience, and it's a mixed audience in gender and in age.
Mm-hmm. So, would you tell me how did you start Fire Orchestra?
Oh,
what was the idea behind gathering so huge bunch of various musicians?
Yeah, I mean, you want to hear what kind of answer do you want to hear? You want to hear the truth, or
I want to hear the truth, of course.
It was a very drunken decision. We were sitting in France after a tour drinking and
with a Fire trio, I mean.
Yeah, with a trio.
Yeah.
And we said, shouldn't we just have all our friends in Stockholm to meet, to drink and eat and just fucking play our trio music together in a big context? And everyone was like, yeah, that's a great idea, let's do it, fucking hell. And then the next day we walked up, we talked about it and said, maybe this is not a bad idea. So we just called around and we got together like 30 musicians and we did that first. That's actually on the first record, Exit.
Yeah.
It's the very first meeting live in Stockholm. And it was such a success for us and with everyone in the band. Everyone was totally ecstatic about it. And it was like a fucking religious meeting with the audience. It was insane. It's like we never experienced anything close to it. It was sick. People were screaming and crying and dancing and it was totally bizarre. So after that experience, we decided to slowly establish the orchestra as a working unit. But with Fire, it's good. We were never in a rush because we were quite busy with other projects in the beginning. So it's a it's the greatest vibe I can think about in Fire with Johan and Andreas, because we never had the rush and we never pushed things. Mm-hmm. We let things happen slowly by itself in a way. But the idea was simply to put all our friends together, and that means, since we are coming from three different directions in a way with music, that means it involved people from the rock scene, from the jazz scene, improv music, contemporary music, anything. So it was from the beginning a crazy mix, and now with a new version of the orchestra that we play in Ljubljana, it's a smaller version, so it's only 19 people, but it's still quite big. So
I can imagine that I mean, to organize such unit is a logistic nightmare. Actually.
Yeah, it's suicide. It's complete fucking violence.
Because I suppose you are all busy. I mean, you are all engaged in various projects, bands.
We really prioritize Fryer and also the orchestra now, so we put a lot of work on it, and we have a great agent in Holland who is helping me since some years, and that helps. And we're pretty, Fire is great because everyone is really sharing the responsibility, and it was like that from the beginning. There's no leader in the group, we all share everything, we take all the decisions together, and that's the way it is, and that's the way it should be, you know.
But you on the stage, because I saw Fire Orchestra last year in Skopje. You are on the stage. You're functioning as a leader, as a conductor and organizer of everything.
Yeah, I lead the thing, but as a group, I'm not the leader. Of course, everyone thinks it's my group because I stand there and I wave my arms and I do the decisions with the conducting, but it's really a three-man business, and you and Andreas are aware also that there will be a lot of focus on me because of my name and because I stand there and conduct, and they are totally cool with it, but we talk about it all the time, and I don't want the focus on me, I want to focus on the trio.
was there also some tensions in the group because of the direction of the music or organization, whatever?
Never. I can say that with my whole heart, with this group, we never had really argue it, because if we see tensions coming up, or everyone thinks different, you know, we are all humans, but we, with fire, we really try to deal with stuff before it gets an issue, before it gets a problem. And I think that's, it's amazing and very rare in my experience working with groups, that it's a real sharing. It's 100% sharing.
Compared to let's say your collaboration with other larger groups where you were a member, what is the difference with Fire Orchestra compared to, let's say, Peter Brützmann did?
Yeah, I mean, it's all different music in a way. The Brützmann and Tet was the last 6 or 7 years of the group was all improvised. We never decided. There was no compositions at all. Mm-hmm. With Fire Orchestra, there's a composition and there's a form, and it and but in general, I mean, it's really difficult to compare, and that's the listener can compare if they want. But I'm not much into comparing. But I mean, of course, the music is different because it involves different musicians totally. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The Brassman Tetet is an all-man business, and if you look on the age scale, it's also different.
Mm-hmm.
So of course it's really different, I would say, with the music. And with Fire, we are much more interested anyway in riffs and rhythmical motifs. Mm-hmm. And stuff, and we try to involve, I think, a wider variety of musical material than Tet was doing. And Tet was great, but it's a different story.
When you do your orchestra work, do you have any, let's say, past listening experience in mind from other orchestras, whatever, from, I don't know, Sandra Orchestra, for example, to, let's say, I don't know, Fela Kuti or who, whatever?
Yeah, I mean, it's the history. I have a huge record collection. I need that because I need to get inspired. I need to get information. I need my kicks. And I get that a lot, not just from music, but a lot from music. And with orchestra work, of course, everyone is aware of Fela Kuti and Sun Ra and Charlie Hayden Liberation Orchestra. It's all there. It's history.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to deal with it. We have to relate to it. But with Fire Orchestra, already from the beginning, we thought, and we think that we actually managed to find something that is quite special, quite unique. The mix of what we're doing, the free stuff and the riff-based stuff and the structures. And I never really heard anything like it. I mean, some things can remind of whatever, like you say, Fela Kuti or Sun Ra, but we never had the intention of being close to anyone on those groups. Mm-hmm.
Or even, let's say, Louis Mohol Orchestra, the Dedication Orchestra.
I really like what they're doing. I love all those groups. I have shitloads of records, and mm-hmm. I love mm-hmm. it, but it's important. The most important thing with the Fire Orchestra is that the music of the trio is transformed into the orchestra. It's a trio music, but mm-hmm. with many people.
Mm-hmm.
That was the intention of the group from the beginning, actually, what we talked about, to make trio music in a large context.
Can we talk about some kind of revival in past, let's say, 10, 15 years, small revival at least, of, let's say, free jazz, free music?
No, I don't think so. I think this is going up and down all the time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think all these, like, revivals and the new this and that, that's all a media construction.
Yeah.
And in reality, it doesn't really exist. I mean, I think the interest for this kind of music jumps up and down, and it also moves around globally. I mean, some years there's shitloads going on in Oslo, and then it sort of fades out and stops because people start to tour, and then it's like the center moves on to Tokyo or to Chicago. Or, I mean, if you look back in the history, you can see how it moves around, basically. and also with audience it goes up and down, but the general feel for me as a touring musician is that we are getting slowly more and more our audience out on the concerts. The problem is that there are not so many organizers, and there is way more groups active than before. So the competition between the groups and musicians are much harder now. If you're 22, new musician, green, unroutine, you have like no chance to get a gig.
How the
fuck should you get a gig at the Konfrontationen or in Saalfelden, or if you don't have an agent, if you don't have records and reviews, it's really, really, really hard to get the gigs these days. So that's a big difference, I would say, from before.
What about the States? Your relation with the States, it's obvious, because I mean your inspiration, at least one big part, actually comes from the States, from the let's say jazz music, free jazz music, improvised music in the States and Bay Area. What's your opinion about the States now?
Nah, that's also a long discussion. If you start to talk about politics, then we have a very long discussion. I mean, it's very double folded. I mean, if you look at the political or the social situations in the States, it's the worst nightmare on earth, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's terrible what's going on there, how people can get so segregated from each other culturally and economically
and socially.
Everything. It's disgusting. It's really fucked up. On the other hand, it's a very it is a very liberal society. If you look at music and art and everything, like you can do shitloads. It's an amazing experience to travel there, to tour. It's fantastic. You meet amazing people and amazing musicians, and it's a great music scene there. So it's a country full of contradictions, I would say. And it's a very double-sided thing to do work there. I love it and I hate it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I'm just reading your collaborations here, your list of collaborations, and I have to ask you about Joe McPhee. I mean, I saw you with the thing with Joe McPhee a few times, and your comment about Joe, really personal. What is so special about his music, his personality?
Yeah, I mean, there's no one like him. I mean, he was here in Eckersdorf some weeks ago.
Hans told me, yes.
Yeah, we did a project. It was fucking amazing. It was fantastic. And he stayed with me and my family, and we were sitting up and drinking whiskey and listening to Ornette Coleman, funny enough, since he passed away now. And Joe is one of my absolutely closest friends and most important teacher ever in music and life and everything. So it's like hard to put words on it, but he understands the importance of sharing, and a lot of his generation don't really believe or understand that concept, I think. But Joe has like, there's no prestige, there's like, it's just about sharing, you know, and how to make the world a little more beautiful in the way we can do it, you know, if we can do it.
How old is he now?
He's 75 this year.
Oh, he looks so vital still. He's so
vital. He's the youngest. He's the youngest I know, you know. No, but he's very, very different from everyone else I know. And I mean, we became really good friends over the years, and with his family and my family and everything. So it's it's mostly private stuff, but I love the guy.
How many concerts do you do per year? Do you count?
Well, there is some statistics somewhere, I don't know, but it's quite a lot. I don't know, maybe...
Is it more now than let's say, 15, 20 years ago?
There is way more offers now, at least.
Uh-huh.
And I turn most of them down, actually, because I want to spend time with my family, and I want to spend time also with on my saxophones, because if you just tour all the time, you don't really develop. I mean, you meet a lot of new people and you hear new things, but there's no time to really develop and to work on your shit. So at this moment, I tour a little too much for my own taste.
Mm-hmm.
Because I like to explore some stuff musically more, and I can own explorations you can do best at home when you have time and no stress.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, my family, I need more time with my family also. We have a 7-year-old and a 1-year-old daughter, so it's a quite special time at the moment. So I try to work more in projects than do the touring I used to do in the past years. With the 2-3 week touring stuff, I don't want to do.
Do you divide time during your staying at home? Divide time between practicing instruments and composing, or do you do it actually both in the same time?
No, when I'm home, that's the only way. When I compose, I have to be home. I can't compose on tours. It's just too stressful, and you're too tired and everything. And the same goes with practicing. I mean, I practice in hotel rooms, and before the gigs, you practice a little bit, but it's more just to keep the level up.
Mm-hmm.
With the lips and with the timing and everything. But if you really want to develop something and find new techniques and new sounds, you really have to do it when you're home, I think.
But when you gather, let's say, with fire, let's say 1 week or I don't know how many days before the tour, do you practice or do you develop it on the spot during the tour?
With fire, we do it when we tour in a way, but we also did like a theater project in Sweden now that was like almost half a year long, so we had much time to talk and discuss and try new ideas out and record stuff. It was fantastic, because that's something I miss sometimes when you work with groups like The Thing or Fire or Swedish Jazz, that there's no time to rehearse.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's only time to play the gigs, it's hard to develop. And if you have 1 or 2 days before the tour starts to rehearse, then you can really add new material and new ideas and try new things out. So it is important to meet before the tour and try things out. But it's hard logistically, and it's also an economical thing, because everyone is living in, like with The Thing, Paul lives in Norway, I live in Austria, and Ingebrigt lives in mm-hmm. Texas. So it's quite expensive to meet somewhere, you know.
Do you exchange ideas or even some, let's say, written scores or recordings, even through mailing, through this new means of, let's say, information or internet or whatever?
Yeah, I mean, that's the way you have to do it nowadays. I mean, you can send links over, you scan some composition and send over, and people check it out. Or I mean, you have to find new ways when you can't meet. I mean, in the early days, when I moved to Stockholm when I was 19 and started to figure out music and shit, it was only with people living in Stockholm,
mm-hmm.
those first years. And you can meet them, you just call them and you meet up and you play. That was a totally different thing. That doesn't happen now.
What's your attitude towards recordings?
It's changing all the time, my attitude. But
do you still believe in old format of, let's say, album or CD or?
I mean, this is also a long discussion. I mean, I'm a discaholic, so I love vinyls, of course, and I don't really care about CDs, and I really don't care about downloads and mm-hmm. streaming and shit for myself, for my personal taste, but for the music I do and for the availability and for the information for other people to check it out, it's of course fantastic with the internet and with all the possibilities you have to check things out, to stream stuff. But it's of course, it's also it's burglary. I mean, the way the music rights are working or not working at the moment with Spotify and YouTube and shit.
Mm-hmm.
It's ridiculous the kind of money that we get from like streaming from Spotify. I mean, I got my yearly payout. I can tell you openly.
Please.
I got my yearly payout from Spotify yesterday. And that was a total of 0.02 euros.
Are you kidding?
No.
So this is totally... Oh, come on.
No. I have shitloads of... I don't choose to put it there, but some of my labels,
mm-hmm.
stuff are up on Spotify. And I know there's a lot of play, you know, there's a lot of streaming and downloading going on all the time. And that's the kind of money we get, you know. And I'm an experienced musician, so I've been doing this for a while, but think about someone young, you don't get shit back. I mean, it's a complete rip-off, if you ask me.
Yes.
That's one side of it, and the other side is it's great that people can get access to the music, and we spread the music in a much more effective way, and you can check things out from the other side of the world, all this shit, but there's an over-belief in the digital... world, the digital system, I think, which is quite upsetting, and it mm-hmm. doesn't. If you think about recordings, I mean, I love making recordings, studio recordings. I'm not so much into live recordings. It has to be something very spectacular if it's live. But I love the mechanism and the act of working in a studio with my groups or solo. Or I mean, you can work focused and you can spend time on different ideas and everything, but if my music will mostly be distributed by Spotify and iTunes and YouTube and stuff, the amount of money I get in can't pay the studio.
Yeah.
So it's the same thing with downloading films. I mean, if people stop buying DVDs or stop going to the movie theaters and only stream for free, there's no money coming back to the movie companies, or they can't make new movies. There's no money coming back to the directors or anything. So I think it's a big problem. People think, ah, it's great, it's for free, and you can find it there for free and blah blah blah. But that's a very short-sighted way to look on culture, and I mean, that's anyway the main problem with fucking European society we're living in now, that everything is so short-sighted. Anyway, you know, you don't look longer than your ass is pointing the other direction.
Are you a member of Musicians Union?
No.
Why?
Because I asked them when I was young, and they said, you're just an amateur, and we don't consider you a real musician, because I was already then playing experimental stuff. And I'm not angry for a long time. I mean, I'm angry for a short time, and then you deal with the problems. But in this case, I'm angry for life.
But
the attitude that the union had towards me when I really needed them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I just choose to become a member of the teachers' union instead, because I was teaching.
Uh-huh.
And that was great. They said, we don't care what kind of music you do. Just come here and join us, and we can help you.
But yeah, but in the light of what you just said, let's say about Spotify, about digital world now.
Yeah, but the Musicians Union doesn't do shit.
I know. Is there, let's say, some other forms of musicians, organization to join and to, let's say, at least negotiate or not fight against?
Yeah, I'm a member of the Composers Association in Sweden, for instance,
mm-hmm.
and a couple of other organizations. So I believe in working together on those matters, of course.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that I was really pissed off at the Musicians Union from the beginning. But we have some good organizations working on that. And also the Copyright Bureau, the STIM, you know, like the GEMA.
Mm-hmm.
In Sweden, they are working on getting new deals with all this internet things going on. So it's moving slowly in some kind of direction. But it's pretty messy at the moment, I would say. I mean,
But it's funny because Spotify has its headquarters in Scandinavia.
I know, Sweden.
Yeah, Sweden.
it's ridiculous. I mean, it was a smart idea, of course, but someone else is making a lot of money, and it's not us. And I mean, I make my money from touring, basically, primarily. And I don't complain. I mean, I survive. I can support my family. I can't complain. That's not my nature anyway. I do what I need to do. But it would be nice if we could get some sense back from our music so we can put it into new recordings and that we can really afford making a proper work, you know. So right now it's really hard. I pay for studio work from my own pocket now, like the way it is, because I want things to be well mixed or well mastered. I want it to survive. I just don't want a crappy live recording of my music, mm-hmm. to be there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I end up spending a lot of money on recordings and not earning much. I mean, some companies pay out royalties here and there, and you get some money back, but I would say it don't even cover the costs I have with recordings.
Mats, this would be the last question. I would like to ask you about your, let's say, your major saxophone players.
Oh, like from an inspirational...
Yeah. Or perhaps even other musicians. Perhaps you're not so fond of saxophone players, or perhaps trumpet. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, the truth is, I think I was more inspired by other instruments, I have to say. Mm-hmm. I mean, Tyler always been extremely important. But that's in a way not from a saxophone standpoint, it's more from an emotional or spiritual standpoint, the music he was doing. And also, if you see like Braxton or Art Ensemble of Chicago, there was more a different thing. I mean, for the music, I was more inspired by the work of Derek Bailey or Cecil Taylor.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, technically, so I was in a way trying to copy or take inspiration from them much more. Or world music, like Korean percussion music, was much more important for me as a saxophone player than listening to Evan Parker or Steve Lacy or something. So that's quite a special thing. I mean, I love Steve Lacy. I adore Steve Lacy and Evan, of course. I mean,
who doesn't?
And it is inspiring, of course, but I think I drew more inspiration from other kinds of music, mm-hmm. and other kinds of instrument, actually.
I think this is actually it. Thank you very much for this, for taking your time.
Now I need to go up and make some food.
Yeah, me too.